Hello there, it's Jonathan Ross with another edition of I Like Films. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. Today, I will be spending time in the company of the celebrated author Roddy Doyle. Now, when you think of Roddy and cinema, you automatically, I think of the three movies that came out in the 80s and 90s. The Commitments, of course, directed by Alan Parker, a huge hit, followed by the other two in what became a loose trilogy, The Snapper and The Van, all three magnificent films, all three stand the test of time, and all three are very much characterized by Roddy's voice. This man who can write incredible dialogue, pinpoints characters with amazing accuracy, and there's just a kind of warmth and a celebration of humanity in his work, which I think is hard to resist. His new movie, Rosie, which is out everywhere right now, is a very different kind of film, focusing instead on the desperate situation that a young family find themselves in over a 36-hour period. Roddy, thank you so much for spending some time with me. So, new movie out, screenplay by you, and this is, I mean, you haven't done that many screenplays, and I'm interested because looking at your books, which, and I've always very much enjoyed your work as a writer, so thank you for the books. You're not a writer who's known for his exposition, you're more kind of like, it's more dialogue and character-based, and I'm imagining that is a good fit for screenplay writing.
I don't know. To be honest with you, I've never given it that much thought. I've been good at compartmentalizing my work insofar as I can sort of put on my novelist's hat for a couple of hours and work on that and take it off and maybe go downstairs and make a cup of coffee and come back up and start being a screenwriter or more often a playwright in more recent years. It's a different style of writing and a different structure. You know, when you're writing a screenplay, anything that isn't dialogue is a set of instructions. So it's not literature. And in a way, it is a different job, you know. You know, for example, in this new film, Rosie, to get to know her, I had to get her to start talking, even though a lot of the time she's talking on the phone and we don't know who she's talking to because she's trying to find somewhere to live. I had to get her talking and I had to find her words. And that's how I got to know her as a character. You know, sometimes I've read and I've heard people say that you have to know your character before you can start. And I always felt that was a bit daft and actually impossible. It's like some sort of absurd insistence that if you're going to go across and start talking to a man or a woman, that you have to know everything about them before you say, do you want to dance? You know, it makes no sense whatsoever in human terms or in other terms. So it does have that in common, getting to know the character, both in fiction and on a script page. For me personally, yeah, getting them to talk is a great way to get to know them, to get the rhythm of how they speak, the little words they use. She refers to people as hun, you know, a term of affection. It's very common in Dublin. But once I gave it to her, I began to visualise her. And she says thanks and thank you, even though she's being told no, with no room at the inn.
There's a massive politeness.
Yeah.
Even in the most difficult circumstances.
So that was part of her, you know, and that actually then became a strong part of her personality for me.
The story, I believe, the story for Rosie, you were inspired by something you heard on the radio.
Yeah, like a lot of people, I was half listening to it. It was on in the kitchen. I was making breakfast one morning, and I started listening to this woman who was describing her day the day before. And it had been her in her car, ferrying kids to school. Then there were two kids who weren't in school, looking after them and trying to find somewhere to spend the next night. And what really gave me pause for thought was that she said her partner couldn't help her because he was at work.
Yeah.
And I thought this was unbelievable, really. This was a couple behaving as almost the Irish Constitution insists that they do. You know, mammy, daddy, and I think they had four or five kids. And the only thing lacking was a house, somewhere to live. They'd lived somewhere for 7 years and the landlord said he was selling it. And they couldn't find anywhere that they could afford near to where their children went to school. Then they couldn't find anywhere at all. And then they were being, she had a list of hotels and B&Bs, and she had to go through the whole routine every day, finding one place to stay for one night. And it didn't allow her any time to find somewhere to live, so to speak. So I thought, well, there's the story, you know, her trying to find. I was going to restrict it to 24 hours at first.
I want to ask you, because it's 36 hours, which is a really, it's very interesting that you limit yourself to that period. And in some ways, perhaps a little frustrating, because of course, in that period, I don't want to give anything away, but there isn't the kind of massive change in their life that normally we would find in a movie. And I'm curious as to what prompted that decision.
I wanted it to be as realistic as possible. I didn't want, you know, I've been asked several times, you know, could you not have ended it differently? And of course I could. Could have ended it in lots of ways.
Of course, yeah.
Lots of different ways. But I didn't want to. I didn't want to give a... I didn't want to let the viewer or myself writing it off the hook, so to speak. And originally I was going to go for 24 hours, but I thought it would be a good idea to let us, both myself when I was writing it and also the viewer, if I was lucky enough to see it made, see them succeed in getting a place to stay one night and what that entailed. And the rush out of the hotel room the following morning. And then people would understand when she starts the whole routine again the following day what's going on. And in part I wondered, because a lot of it is set in the car, and I wondered, could I get away with this? But just before I'd started it, I saw that film Lock.
Yeah.
You know, with Tom Hardy driving away from everything he shouldn't be driving away from. And I thought it was marvellous.
Yeah.
And the only time where I felt a bit let down was when the camera was on a bridge or something showing the car going under the bridge. I thought that was totally unnecessary, and it would have been much, much better to keep it all in the car.
Did you have a word with the director after the... is he aware of this kind of...
We would have had these conversations, but no, you know, the scenes that aren't in the car, I wrote them.
Yeah.
I quickly
popped
onto the fact, that they do have to get out now and again.
Yeah.
Like anybody who's ever had children in a car,
but it is,
need to go to the toilet, for example.
But it's very powerful because it is very, that claustrophobia and that kind of desperation and that feeling of, especially with young children, and one of the children is a toddler, of course, that feeling of like needing to keep an eye on them the whole time, and that panic sometimes that you have when they're out of your sight. And of course, that I think is very, very skillfully captured.
Yeah, we were blessed with the kids. Paddy Brannock, the director... he's a great guy to talk to, fascinating man to listen to. But you know that advice to say never work with children or dogs or animals? He said that having the children on the set, because it was a very low budget, so it was made very quickly, there wasn't room for, you know, experimentation per se. But it had a great influence on everybody. And I was only on the set a couple of times because I served no purpose, but there was a lovely atmosphere despite the cold. And the grimness of the story. And the kids were absolutely... I was quite shocked when I saw them, even looking over the camera at them when they were working and the faces on them, you know, they were living those things. How they do it, I don't know. But Paddy said at one point when the little boy cries, Paddy heard him after the scene and he was saying to somebody else, whispering to somebody else, I just taught myself how to cry.
That's amazing.
Which I'm sure he'll get great mileage out of. As he goes through life.
That will serve him in good stead for many, many, many years.
I'd imagine so, yeah.
The young woman in the lead role.
Sarah Green.
Amazing. She's amazing.
She is absolutely brilliant. She's not a Dublin woman. She's from Cork. And that's the first little shock for me because the Dublin accent is bang on. And the other shock for me on a level that's nothing to do with the film itself, but it's not so long ago I saw her playing Alice in an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland.
Wow.
And here she is now playing the mother of four children, you know.
Yeah.
But she is brilliant. Yeah, she's absolutely brilliant.
Have you been, have you spoken to or did you have any contact with the woman who you first heard talking about this on the radio?
No, I didn't. I didn't feel a need to, you know. I had just started a novel at the time and I wasn't deep enough into it to feel particularly in a rush to, you know, go up and continue. So I pushed it aside and wrote a treatment for the film really, really quickly, a couple of days only, playing James Brown. I thought that would give me the energy to do it. And I did it on spec. I didn't contact Element, the film company, at all, or anyone else. I just did it on spec. And I started, and I thought, I was open to the idea of maybe trying to contact her if I felt it was necessary. But actually, I didn't, for the first draft particularly, I didn't feel any need to talk to anybody. For, you know, things like, as you mentioned earlier, like the anxiety, it's not so long ago I would have had a car full of kids. And granted, I was leaving a comfortable house and bringing them to a nice school, progressive schools or whatever. But, you know, the slightest thing can knock your day sideways, and there's all sorts of anxieties. And so I just, you know, if you like, I used my memory of that, but also when you decide to physically restrict the characters, it's easy to imagine the conversations and the utterances and the kids at the back and the things that they will say. So I never met that particular woman, and I don't know her name. I hope she's living in a house now that's got nice and comfortable and she's well. But I just didn't feel the need, you know, very quickly from my point of view. Even a lot of what I would write, you know, it might start off with some sort of autobiographical spark, some notion, something I heard or did or remember. But that drops away really quickly, and that's important, you know, really important. It stops being anything to do with me very, very quickly. And it was the same with this. Once I got going on it, I didn't have to think, what did she say? What did she say? I began to come to grips with it. You know, later drafts, we spoke to people from, you know, a homeless charity and got a bit of jargon about, you know, the city council credit card and stuff like that. That adds a bit of authenticity to it.
Yeah, well, that those kind of, yeah, those little notes really ring true and resonate with you. Yeah. And you get a feeling of this, the reality of this. But I was curious as to, were you tempted? Obviously, you are a writer of fiction and you're basing that fiction here on reality. But were you tempted, because I guess you wanted this story out there. You wanted people to know about this community. Were you tempted to make a documentary? Were you tempted to actually just...
No, I've never... I can't remember ever being tempted to make a documentary, to be honest. The only time ever where I felt an urge, and it stopped quickly, I saw that James Baldwin documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, and I thought it was extraordinary. I mean, I love his work, and I think he's a fascinating man, and it was just brilliantly put together and the rest of it. And I was thinking, walking away from the cinema, I was thinking to myself, I'd love to do something similar called I Am Not Your Catholic. But I calmed down by the time I got off. By the time I got off the bus, I calmed down. But I did jot the odd note, because I do think there's a, you know, it was possibly the best documentary I ever saw, really. And then the music at the end, you know, what's his name? Kendrick Lamar. Absolute, the punch, you know, it was just brilliant. But no, I didn't feel like to do a documentary. I mean, as you said, I write fiction, and that's my strength. Yeah. You know, I'm quite content living in Ireland. I'm quite happily an Irish citizen. I like the place, and I like the direction it's gone in, and it's I've enjoyed watching it shift and change as I've got older. But I do think it's outrageous that there are, in a very, very small country, such a large proportion, you know, such a large number of people, particularly children, who are homeless. And, you know, the city I grew up in, the area I grew up in, was full of council housing, you know, but the state doesn't seem to think it has a responsibility to do it anymore. Mm. So it's one of the things that could get me worked up and angry, you know. But there's no point in me, you know, I share that opinion with hundreds of thousands of people. But when I heard that woman on the radio, I thought to myself, that's the story. Yeah. So if I can do anything at all, it's to write a story, not to, you know, there are current affairs programs, and women like that are frequently on them.
Yeah.
So it's a bit, I'd be doing is replicating it. Whereas I thought, if I do have a strength, it's the ability to tell a story.
So, and it's probably easier to reach an audience, I would have thought, with a piece of fiction, because they're going, however, there's a sort of connection to your name where, and I know this is unfair in terms of the work you've written recently, but the connection name is where one expects a certain lightness and a certain level of humour. And there are a couple of moments for you, but overall, this is a fairly bleak scenario.
Yeah, well, like that kind of reputation doesn't interest me, really.
Mm.
You know, and again, it's a bit like, I'm quite capable of shutting down the Rosie script when I'm working on it and working on something much lighter.
Yeah.
A different compartment of my head.
Yeah.
And as to whether people go to it and then come away thinking, well, that wasn't what I expected.
Well, it wasn't Roddy Doyle film.
Well, it is. I wrote it. Well, it's a Paddy Brannock film insofar as he directed it.
But you know what I'm saying. You do know what I'm saying.
But I also wrote The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, for example, which isn't a barrel of laughs.
Yeah.
And that's 23 years ago.
But that was converted into an opera, I believe, rather than a movie.
Yes, it was, yeah.
Which is a whole other interesting area. That's not my idea of a fun night out. Was it a good opera?
Oh, it was brilliant.
Well,
I wasn't involved in it, so I'm not being boastful, but it was absolutely brilliant. To hear Claren McFadden, an African-American soprano, singing lines that came from my novel.
It was quite amazing.
Unbelievable.
But I was not in any way, this was not a critical note for me here. I was just curious as to whether, here's a story you want to reach as many people as possible.
Yeah.
And you've told it in a very honest way.
Yeah.
And I think a very engrossing way. And yet at the same time, when you sweeten the pill of something like that with a moment of what we would call Roddy Doyle-esque humour, for want of a less unwieldy term, perhaps you would reach more people. And I was wondering whether there was a degree in which you think, okay, what do I want to achieve here? And how do I best achieve it? Or would that be too craven? Would that be too cynical an approach?
It never occurred to me, to be honest with you. You know, I've been writing in a very disciplined, if you like, way, either full time or, you know, using time that I could grab between teaching and putting children to bed, you know, 25 years ago. And I've done a huge variety of things. And I don't think in terms of what do people expect if they pick up a Roddy Doyle book or if they go to a Roddy Doyle film. And it's nearly 20 years since the last one.
Of course.
Ultimately, I saw it as an Irish film in some ways. And I'm rarely parochial. I see no reason why somebody reading a book set in Dublin but lives on the other side of the world wouldn't get it. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence that that is the case. People get it. But I suppose if the film was to have some sort of a propaganda value, I was thinking of Irish people watching it because ultimately they will elect Irish politicians. And if it's an issue at the next general election, good. Great. Yeah, yeah. And it's being broadcast on Irish TV. It's no huge contribution to the debate, but it actually does contribute somehow.
Well,
so that makes me...
It's a massive contribution content. That it raises the profile of the issue substantially.
Yeah, and it's kind of... It's an invisible one, because the people we see on the streets, the homeless people we see on the streets, they're a different kind of person. They are of themselves a different story. You know, I read a book recently. Unfortunately, I can't remember the name of the author, but she interviewed a load of men and women who were on the streets in London. And it was absolutely fascinating. Only one occupation or job was repeated, and that was the military, which is not a surprise, really, when you think about it. I'm assuming it would be the same in the United States, and I'm not sure about Ireland. They were different ages, they were different education levels, and different things had knocked them out of society, so to speak. Grief, for example. There was one young man. His wife died when he was 20 and he's left with a baby and he can't cope. Oh, you know, so they're a different story. But we don't see the homeless families. They're not sleeping in doorways, you know. And I've seen couples going to bed together, if you like, in doorways, putting down the cardboard.
But not families, not with kids.
No, it's like young couples who should be in a bed sit.
Yeah.
But bed sits in Ireland don't exist anymore. They were voted out of existence. The one room flat, you know.
Yeah.
That's another group of comfortable people not even realising that they're actually getting rid of a layer of accommodation that suits people in their 20s down to the ground.
I don't want to put people off seeing it, but it is such a bleak story. And because
it is a bleak story, but it's really... I think Paddy and the cast and Red did a really, really good job. And it's the family are lovely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's they are everything that you would want to see in a functional family.
Yeah.
A loving father, a mother... Bright, sparky kids.
An incredible patience.
Yeah.
Under in the most awful situation, in the most unfair situation.
Oh, it's terribly unfair. Yeah.
You know, this is on me. I thought, they're gonna upset me. These people making this film are gonna upset me with this one thing they're doing. They're teasing one thing. I don't want to spoil it for people, but they're teasing one thing, and I'm gonna be so annoyed when this happens. And then it didn't happen. Okay, I'm pleased to say, buddy, the little girl who's so attached to her little toy.
Yeah.
And I think they're gonna make her lose that fucking toy, and I'm gonna be so upset when she loses that toy. And it's such a really kind of annoyingly obvious way of tweaking my emotions.
Yeah.
And then of course you didn't do that.
Tempted myself. We've all, you know, those of us kids, we've all been there. We've all felt terribly guilty. We've gone back to places, looking under chairs, looking under, trying
Never
to find the
it.
Thing. Yeah, and then trying to find something that looks exactly like it. One of my children had finches and one of them flew away. He reached the conclusion that it had flown back to the pet shop.
That's
And all perfect. The guilt, anxiety, you know, why didn't we shut the windows, et cetera, lifted immediately. I drove him to the pet shop with his brother and sister while my wife phoned ahead and said what was happening, and they were waiting when he arrived.
Guess who's just flown in?
Yeah. And he was knackered. He was exhausted. I held that prop, if you like, right through the script so that it could be used again at the very end. At the very, very end. And it's a moment for the father, without giving anything away. It's a moment for the father.
You know, I mean, because when I first watched the film, I felt, initially, I'll be honest with you, I felt slightly unsatisfied by it. I loved the people in it. But the ending, because it doesn't transform their lives dramatically at the end of the film,
But that's very deliberate.
Yeah, the more I've thought about it, the more I've enjoyed the experience, the more I'm thinking, okay, I really want to see it again, but B, I actually have great respect for what you achieved and what they achieved, what the people working with you achieved on that. Because it's very truthful.
Mm.
But my question for you here is, at what point do you, not sacrifice, but what point do you make the decision, not to deliver a crowd-pleasing moment. It doesn't have to be a neat and tidy ending. For example, The Van doesn't have a tidy ending.
No.
It has a thoroughly satisfying ending, a rather beautiful ending, but it's not a kind of... It's not... Because these aren't people who are... who lead predictable lives anyway. You know, they feel real. And so... But at what point do you think, okay, I'm not going to give people a traditional narrative structure here, a three-act structure. Something happens, something gets worse, something gets better, or worse, but, you know.
Well, I was constantly asking myself, why am I writing this? Why am I doing this? And I felt in a way that the only way to do it honestly, people who are in that rut, and it is a rut, it's a daily thing. It's like it's a nightmare. It's like
grind.
Kafka, in a way. But they're, the ante is up the bit that they don't have a roof over their head at this point, and it's getting later and later and later, and it's dark. And I felt, well, if they get somewhere to stay, that robs the previous hour and a half of its power. Or if it's even worse, you know, worse, it in a way, in a different kind of way, lifts, if you like. If it, I was hoping in a way that the audience would feel... uncomfortable watching it in a way. And if there's some, if something dramatic happened at the end, either good or bad, it would lift, I think, a lot of that discomfort.
And that's the focus instead?
Yeah.
Mm. That is interesting. I mean, it is, you know, it's very powerful. It reminded me a little of, and comparisons are sometimes irrelevant, but of the kind of, you know, early TV stuff that we grew up with, like Ken Loach would make, you know, those kind of Cafe Come
Home.
Yeah,
well, I grew up that as well, of course, you know, so it rubs off, doesn't it, really?
What was your favourite kind of movie growing up, though? What kind of movies did you seek out for entertainment? What was the, young Waddy into...
I was a kid?
Yeah.
Well, you didn't seek out anything, really, because you got what you were given. You know, up until the age of about 10, there was only one. We only had one television channel, so it was Westerns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Westerns. No harm. Years later, when I, you know, in my 20s, and I read about John Ford, and I go to his films, and I went to them, and I realised I'd seen them all before. I just didn't know they were John Ford films. They were John Wayne films, in a way.
So you're kind of a fan of cinema. You were someone who sought out cinema.
Yeah, basically. From a... I had a friend whose uncle used to bring him to an art house cinema when we were in school. We were 15 or 16. And bring him to a different film every Friday night. And for some reason, his uncle couldn't do it. My friend said, will you come along? And we went, and it was Amacord, the Fellini film.
Yeah.
We were probably too young, certainly in Ireland in the mid-1970s. We really shouldn't have been there, but that added to the wonderfulness of it.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen anything like it. And in many ways, I haven't seen anything like it since. Just the brilliance of it, the wildness of it, the beauty of it, the grotesqueness, everything. And the music, everything about it. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before. Yeah. And ever since then, really, I suppose it's then you realise that these films are made by individuals. You know, I was only really at that point copping on to the fact as well that, you know, a book like Catch 22 is written by a man called Joseph Heller, and he might have written more books as well. At that point, he hadn't, which is why I always remember it. But Flann O'Brien, and then a bit later, Virginia Woolf, for example, when I realised, oh, there are more Virginia Woolf books.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was a little bit like that when I was a teenager, yeah. Film and books went hand in hand, really.
Flann O'Brien, have any films been made of Flann O'Brien's work?
Good question. If there have any been made, it's pretty obscure. There have been attempts again and again and again to make At Swim Two Birds. I think Brendan Gleeson has had it for a long, long time, trying to get it made.
It's weird because I haven't read that much Irish literature particularly, but I've read At Swim Two Birds, which I adored when I was younger. But I must admit, I didn't read it and think this would make a film. And you think, that's a peculiar thing.
No, but then I, when I read Irvin Welsh's book, Trainspotting, I mean, I got it when it was just out. And I loved it. I thought it was absolutely amazing. But it never occurred to me it would make a film.
No.
You know, then it became this glorious monster a few years later.
When we look back on what's the Barrytown trilogy, that's quite remarkable because I guess you didn't set out to make three films. You didn't set out to necessarily write three novels.
Really lucky. You know, and then it stopped in a way because I made one film after that that was an original script.
Was that when Brendan
met Trudy? Yeah, and then Rosie is the fifth. So it's nearly 20 years, as I said, since I was involved in a film.
So why that gap?
Well, I was actually very, very lucky in that I co-wrote a script called The Commitments, and it was made. Then I wrote The Snapper, and it was made.
Yeah.
Then almost immediately wrote The Van, and it was made. Then there was a lot of interest in Paddy Clark, And because it was such a monster, and I began to feel weighed down by it, I kind of batted it all away at the time.
What, the Paddy Clark was such a monster, the book?
Yeah.
And this is about, it's a 10-year-old, isn't it?
10-year-old boy. I won the Booker Prize with that in 93. And it's a strange one. I was very happy winning the prize, but I wanted to get away from it as quickly as possible. I didn't want to be defined by it or by the commitments or any individual piece of work. So I just put my head down and started work. There was a lot of interest in A Star Called Henry. I wrote a script. We nearly had the money to make it. And then it's a horrible world, the world of cinema. It goes from hot to cold. Mm. And there's no intervening period at all. And it went from hot. I was told, we might be going to Prague to meet a possible actor. And I said, fine. You know, luckily I didn't have a bag pack. I wasn't standing beside the phone waiting to go. But nothing happened and it died. And that happened with a couple of other things I was involved in. So in a way, I was very lucky insofar as the first things I did were made. And a bit unlucky in that reality then arrived. And the reality is that a lot of the work you do never gets made.
Yeah.
But luckily, I've always been able to balance that by working on a novel. I'd always be working on a novel. And they've always been published. So I would hate, particularly in Britain or Ireland, to be involved in film writing only.
Just a screenwriter.
Yeah, I would
hate it. Independent on, really, you're at the mercy of others so much.
Very much. It's very whimsical sometimes, I think.
You said something earlier about writing, though, which surprised me. You said you put James Brown on. That would give you the energy to get through this script. Mm. Okay. Most people I know who write don't write with music, certainly not music with lyrics, because it's distracting.
I rarely write with lyrics, but I just thought, particularly with James Brown, there's a couple of, you know that, the Payback?
Oh, yeah.
Soundtrack album. I played that, and I love the story behind that, and he was commissioned to write a soundtrack, and then they turned it down because it was too like a James Brown. And I'm hoping he laughed before he, picked up the ashtray and flung it at the wall, you know, because it's so absurd. But I think it's an amazing album, and then there's another live one recorded in Paris, and I can't remember the name of it, but there's the beat is more important than the lyrics. And
so the lyrics don't tug at your brain, though, and take you away?
You don't hear the lyrics. You hear the human voices, but they're instruments rather than the message, you know? And I do listen to quite a lot of music when I'm working, but yet rarely rock and rarely music with lyrics. And even sometimes if it was liturgical music and the language is Latin, I still wouldn't listen to it because it's too distracting. But somehow or other, I can listen to other music. Depending on, sometimes if I'm on the first draft of something, I can listen to fairly rhythmic, fairly strong, if you like, or bouncy music. Whereas later on, it would be more ambient. Yeah. Brian Eno has got me through more jobs.
I bet he has.
Yeah. Now, whereas Philip Glass, early Philip Glass now, music with changing parts, the last couple of hours in the afternoon, if I'm filling empty pages, that is, if I ever met Philip Glass, I'd have a lot to thank him for.
Can I ask, do you then now, it must be easier in some ways now that you can stream a long album or something and therefore you don't have to break the moment of concentration to get up and flip the disc over?
Well, I have a record player and I have a CD player and I have, of course I can use Spotify or whatever, but I like the routine in the morning of putting on a record, and when it's really working, when I am really, really working, I don't notice that there's no music playing.
Yeah.
That it's the only sound is the click, 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 click of the needle.
I thought that was your son's bird returning and trying to get back in through the window.
No, that finch would be a fair age now. The boy is 26.
The oldest finch in Ireland.
It would indeed.
And so what are you working on now? I mean,
editing a novel. I'm hoping to deliver it next month.
Wow.
What else am I doing? Just about to start a play. I'll wait till I'm finished the novel and then.
And when you write a play, though, do you approach it differently to a screenplay? Is that because of location as much as anything?
Partly that. You're constricted in a way, much more so. And also you don't have the luxury of or the possibility of a camera coming right up to a character's face.
So you can't do that close-up emotion and...
It's a different kind of acting. You've probably seen it yourself how sometimes... And I know acting is a mystery to me, so I'm chancing my arm here somehow, but I think it's true. We've seen great screen actors who are wooden on stage. Mm. It's quite shocking sometimes. And then we've seen great stage actors who are diabolical in front of a camera.
Bruce Willis.
Was he on stage?
I saw him on stage. Oh, he was terrible. Mm. He was phoning it in. He was in Misery, the Stephen King thing, and I suspect he only took the part because he knew he could spend most of the evening lying in a bed.
It's true. Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah, so and there was one that really surprised me. It went to Cat in the Hot Tin Roof in New York, and it was the Jason Patrick. He's got great presence in front of a camera, but then I saw him in Cat in the Hot Tin Roof on a stage in New York, and he was diabolical. That sounds cruel, but he actually was. He was what works in front of the camera, almost that wooden quality that he has, where he doesn't actually do much. He needed to do a lot more on stage. It was terrible.
But you know what's interesting when you think about that? Because sometimes someone is cast, and whether it's the casting people or whether it's the directors, but they take advantage of the limitations of someone's performance and they can turn them into... Keanu Reeves is not a particularly expressive actor. He's not a particularly believable human being. That sounds unkind, but on screen. And yet, when you look at some of his early works, you look at In the Matrix, he's perfectly suited for that. You look at Speed, he was perfect in that
role. I was great in Speed. I find The Matrix films unwatchable.
Why do you find that? What is that about them?
I think it's the dialogue, really.
Ah, this is interesting.
It's just so silly, and it's not even silly in an entertaining way.
You mean the phrase, I know Kung Fu? You thought that was silly? Well, you are a very demanding audience member.
They rattle off the explanations to each other. I just find it...
But you see, this is you.
Literally, when I say I find them unwatchable, I've watched half of one.
Yeah. But so, this is you as a writer and as a dramatist looking at that, and you're seeing the parts moving too clearly. Their use of exposition or their use of dialogue from the plot is clumsy. It's clumsy, and therefore, I imagine, unacceptable to you as someone who wants it to be slightly
finer-tuned.
Well, yeah, but
I'm aware of the fact that there are people all around me having a ball, loving it, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go behind the screen and pull the plug.
You're not dismissive of this, but
no,
at the same time,
no,
it doesn't work
for
you.
Me.
So that must be, you must be a bit of a nightmare to go out with.
I believe I'm great company.
No, of course you do, Waddy. But going to see a play or a film with you, I would be on the edge of my seat.
Well, luckily those close to me share exactly the same taste.
Or at least that's what they say to you.
I don't watch soaps anymore. I did when I was a kid because they were on the telly, you know. Back of Coronation Street in the era of Hilda Ogden and things
but
like that.
But Coronation did have, for the many years, where there's some great writing. I don't know what it's like now.
So I believe, but my mother died this time last year. She was 92, but we were able to, myself and my siblings were able to look after her at home until towards the end. You know, it wasn't easy. She was getting more and more ill. But she was a great fan of the soap, so I ended up watching a lot more than I ordinarily would. And herself and my father had watched them for decades, all their lives really, since the television came into the house. And I remember one night, there was a character, middle-aged woman, in the hall, looking up the stairs, and my mother said, she's going to say, I'm going up for a bath, love. And the character turned around and said, I'm going up for a bath, love.
Yeah.
And I thought, it changed my mind about the soaps in a way, because once my mother was beside me while she was well enough to explain the shorthand, so to speak, and the predictability of it, it was great fun.
And presumably she took some comfort, she took some joy in...
It was my father said it, because they used to tape them all and watch them, and he said in the morning, during the day we use our brains, just watch the soaps.
Unwind.
And they got the shorthand, they knew how, in a way, unlike life it was, but they still became quite engrossed. And they were of a generation that used to commentate right through
while
the program.
Watching show, yes.
My father shouted at the radio and then shouted at the telly now and again. But they'd also, you know, we've seen him before. What was he in before? That was constant all the time.
But lovely, that kind of joy, which I think that's something you've captured often. And you, to an extent, capturing Rosie, that family interplay, that kind of dynamic that goes on.
Because it's a lovely family.
Mm.
That was the thing. It was really important. The father, you know, the temptation is almost like, it's almost automatic. You when you're writing or when you're, you know, a lifetime absorbing culture, the temptation is there almost automatically, if such a thing is possible, to make the father a bit unpleasant, to put it mildly. And I've done that because it's actually often true. But the father here is a very loving man. He's doing his best, you know. So the family, it's a lovely family. The kid, you know, the eldest is doing very well in school, but she's not able to do her homework properly anymore.
Yeah.
She's doing it in the car.
Yeah,
and you know, I suppose it's up to people coming away if they're moved by the thing to wonder what happens next.
Well, you know, it's lovely. You find the drama, you find a compelling drama in tiny moments, which in other circumstances might not be a big thing, but forced into this kind of pressure cooker situation, which they have no control, you can see how it chips away.
Yes, and it also, it's funnily enough, you know, looking at little things. when you think, you know, she's using a mobile phone, therefore she needs credit, therefore she need, you know, she's going to have to plug it in somewhere. These are added problems. Now, look at, you know, 20 years ago, she'd have been looking for money and a payphone that worked.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's different. But these little moments that ordinarily you mightn't want to see in a film actually add to it, because it adds to the anxiety. And it's an anxiety that we all recognise. You know, we all recognise it. The fear of losing the child's toy, running out of credit, all these things. We get a little bit closer to her experience when we see these things happen. And they are mundane, and that's, you know, that's part of the thing. And also, sometimes I find when I'm writing a novel, if I'm adding mundane details, it's often to prolong the tension. You know what I mean? It actually, it's moments before the big moment.
Yeah, and those moments, because they're that's human life. That's,
yes, of course.
It builds to that.
Yeah.
It's amazing to meet you. Thank you so much for coming
on
and spending some time with
me.
Roddy Doyle, what a charming and lovely man. And Rosie, which is out everywhere this week, and I said I can recommend. When I first saw it, I felt like I needed a bit more in terms of drama, a bit more in terms of a kind of a neater ending, perhaps. But as I thought about it before I got to meet Roddy, I came to realise that, no, I don't think it is lacking anything. I think it is instead perhaps all the more powerful for the reality of the situation and the way that he chooses to portray it. So go and see Rosie if you get the chance. We'll be back with another one of these very soon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Thanks for listening.